The information in this podcast is alleged and based on our understanding and research at the time of recording. We make every effort to ensure the accuracy of the information presented, but we cannot guarantee that all data is entirely accurate or complete. The opinions expressed herein are solely those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views of any organizations mentioned. Listeners are encouraged to conduct further research and consult professionals before making decisions based on any information provided in this podcast. For further information and full case files, including crime scene photos and case reports, please go to the link in our show notes. Viewer discretion is advised. Previously on The Stack Deck.
Was the apartment on fire when you left the apartment?
When I left the door, no, but I remember looking back as I was running down the hallway and I did see like a few wisps of smoke coming out from under the door.
Fire experts have bought into the idea that David, in the premeditation of his suicide, believed that he needed two ignition sources just in case one failed. As you can imagine, there are several problems with this hypothesis. How would it even be possible for this to happen within the split second it would have to for Miss X to see just a whiff of smoke coming from underneath the door as she's running down the hall, as she is reported to authorities?
The lighter itself, so you initially saw that on the counter behind him over by the dishwasher. Mm-hmm. Any idea where that lighter ended up?
I know from my mom and talking with her that when she went into the apartment the next week to start boxing things up, she noticed that the lighter was laying somewhere over by the kitchen table, which was pretty far distance. And when she was picking up garbage and things, she had moved it onto the counter that was closer, I think, to the stove.
And so she abandoned him.
How do you know he didn't know what was going on?
When he came...
Let me say this. Let me add this.
Yeah.
For a defense attorney and court, what they're going to say is, well, of course he did it himself because he was in a psychosis. He was out of control. He was doing things that were irrational and unpredictable. Now, prove to me that that didn't happen.
Looking at his autopsy, and I saw him at the hospital like this too, it's like, could the kid even see well enough with his hands partially degloved, virtually blind, and he's in a smoky apartment.
Welcome back to the Stack Debt podcast series, episode 6, The Plymouth Police Department. On Monday, February 12th, 3 days after David's passing, I was put in contact with the lead investigator on the case, Sergeant Heath Bird. In our 45-minute telephone discussion, I explained to the lead investigator about David's mental health condition, that David wanted to end his 11-month toxic marriage and move back home, how vulnerable he was, and how we witnessed Miss X smack him across the face while he was in psychosis. I informed him that David had never been suicidal or violent, and I couldn't imagine why Miss X couldn't have at least called 911 if David was indeed threatening to commit suicide in such a strange and awkward way. Clearly, she would have plenty of time to call 911. I also shared that David said she'd go ballistic if he talked to her about getting a divorce. None of this seemed to bother Mr. Bird. He assured me, quote, "No, David grabbed Miss X and pushed her out of the apartment, locked the door behind him, and then started the fire." Could there be more definitive evidence that David took his life by self-immolation than for him to lock the door and then start the fire? No, there couldn't be. Sad thing is, none of it is true. I went to my son's funeral, eulogizing him based upon false information, and I soon learned that that was just the beginning of the falsehoods put forth by the Plymouth Police Department. On February 28th, 20 days after David's passing, I met with the lead investigator at the Plymouth Police Department. It was in some ways in preparation for the meeting he was going to have with Miss X the following day. At least I thought so. I brought with me the audio recording of Miss X's testimony that my daughter made 2 days before the funeral, which he was going to listen to and transcribe. I reiterated what I had shared on the telephone 3 days after David's passing, that David had suffered from psychosis, was completely vulnerable, and could be taken advantage of by anyone.
When we went to David's apartment that night that we got him into the emergency room, he was not intoxicated. He had not smoked any pot, none of that. And it was the scariest, most frightening thing in the world. I could have told David to jump out the window, and he would have. He didn't know what was going on.
But he continued to assure me David locked the door and then started the fire. But then he added some more heartbreaking news. He informed me that David was not rescued for 30 minutes because they believed he was lying in wait. I didn't know what he was talking about. My chill David lying in wait? I couldn't believe it. Keep in mind, I'm still in what I would call a deep mourner's fog. Since I had not yet seen the 21 photographs of the knife, my mind naturally went to guns. I told Mr. Bird that I didn't believe David owned any guns, but I would check with my son-in-law, who would certainly know since David had lived on their farm. But what's interesting and not surprising, Mr. Bird doesn't mention anything about a gun or a knife, not one word. He doesn't identify what kind of weapon it might be or why they were led to believe David would attack them in the first place, just that he was lying in wait and that he remained in the apartment for 30 minutes. I was devastated. Not surprisingly, when I requested the records, I was told by the Plymouth police that this interview, which occurred in one of their interview rooms, was not recorded, no audio or video. If this is true, it is a break from basic police investigative protocol. If it is not true and it was destroyed, then it's just more evidence of a cover-up and obstruction of justice. When I left the police headquarters that afternoon, I was sickened by what I heard and anxious for the lead investigator to have a productive and thorough interview with Miss X the following afternoon to see if we could ever make any sense of this horrific tragedy. I don't believe I could have been more disappointed by what I heard on that audio recording. The arrogance, stupidity, and total disrespect for the subject matter was shocking, and the idea of serious police misconduct was now as obvious as the noonday sun. On March 1st of 2018, 21 days after David's tragedy, Miss X sat down with lead investigator Bird for what turned out to be a one-hour interview. I refer to this as the No Worries interview. Unlike the night of the fire, the lead investigator would now be aware of many serious problems with Miss X's testimony, but he wasn't. As you'll soon learn, he was more concerned with putting Miss X's mind at ease than asking her serious questions about her testimony and forensic evidence that was now available.
Sergeant Heathford, Batch Number 61. Case number 18005796. The date is March 1st, 2018. The time now is 16:58 hours. This will be a case statement with first name. Last name is Elmquist. Interviews are taking place at the Plymouth Police Department. And just so you know, you don't have to talk to me if you don't want to. You're not under arrest for anything. You can feel free to leave at any point, okay? So, you know, typically, when something like this happens, our patrol officers try and get a statement from any witnesses or involved parties the night that it happened.
Mm-hmm.
What happens, though, is we learn other information as things go along, and there's questions that need to be asked that they probably didn't think to ask you that night.
Sure.
And that's kind of why I wanted to sit down and talk to you.
Okay.
Just to answer some of those questions and a little more of the backstory about kind of what led up to this.
Mm-hmm.
David's family obviously has a lot of questions about the events that led up to this, and you know, hopefully we can answer some of those questions for them.
Have they contacted you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's understandable.
Mm-hmm.
It's their son.
Yep. Absolutely.
And I don't know what your relationship is with them, but they're struggling,
mm-hmm.
and I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
can I ask when they contacted me?
David's dad reached out to me fairly soon after this happened.
Sure.
And within the first couple of days,
okay.
just wanting to talk to me and wanting to know what I knew and
mm-hmm.
stuff. I mean, just questions that I would have as a parent.
Yep.
So.
Mm-hmm.
So, how long were you and David married?
Almost 11 months to the day.
Okay.
Our anniversary is March 11th.
Okay. And then, how long had you been together before that?
We started dating 2004, about 4 years.
Okay.
I think. But I've known him since I was 8 or 9.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we grew up in church together.
Okay.
So we were really good friends throughout our childhood into high school and sort of lost touch when he went to college.
Sure.
Went our separate ways and reconnected a year or two later.
Okay. So at what point did things change with David? Was there signs of this 5 years ago, 2 months ago?
You know, it's easier to say now kind of looking back.
Yeah.
There have been some small instances. Usually when he was very intoxicated, where he would sort of act in kind of a bizarre way.
Sure.
Of course, at the time, you know, it was, he's drunk or he's whatever. Thinking back, you know, obviously I kind of rehash everything.
Sure.
And think, was this a sign? Should I have known? I work in, I'm very involved in the mental health field. I'm a teacher and I work with students who have a lot of mental health.
Okay.
Or mental illnesses and all sorts of stuff. So I pride myself on being really aware. But obviously when you live with them, you're just not as much, and I know that. So I got home and he was kind of like elated. Like he was just like, oh yeah, things are so great and whatever. And I was like, okay, you know, like, you know, I just put on, I'm a case manager, so I just kind of put those pants back on and was like, all right, you know, I was asking a lot of questions, and he was sort of irrational, wasn't making a ton of sense. Like, his thoughts were like, we were talking about one thing, and then all of a sudden it was like way over here, and then it was back over here, and then they weren't making a ton of connections. But as we talked, I like to think I'm a pretty rational person, so as we talked, you know, he sort of started to come back down, I guess, to earth, sort of, is how I describe it. So he started to calm down, I think. He was just kind of really wrapped up in whatever. Started to make more sense. He said a few things that I was like, that's weird, you know. But I called him out, and I was like, David, that doesn't make any sense, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What you just said, and he, after thinking about it, was like, yeah, and all that. Yeah, you're right. You know, after, like, went to bed fine, woke up the next day, and I knew something was made. Like, I couldn't really figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
He woke up and he said something along the lines of, like, I need to drive you to work today. And I thought, well, he has a truck. Maybe it snowed and the roads are bad or something.
Sure.
Said, oh, is it snow or the roads bad? No, I just have a feeling I need to drive you to work today. He said, well, no, that's fine. Like, I can drive myself. No, Emily, I need to drive you to work. The world is ending, I said. I said, why, you know, why are you thinking this? And he said I don't even remember what the reasons were. And he said, no, David, the world isn't ending. He's like, yeah, no, it's fine. Okay, it's fine. So he called his boss, and he's like, yep, I'm just going to be a little bit late. Goes to work. Fine. I go to work. I get to work, I have 6 missed calls from him. I mean, it literally takes me, we left at the same time, 15 minutes to get to work. I'm like, then he's calling me again. You know, so I'm like, okay, answer it. I say, what's up? You know, he called me 6 times, is everything okay? He said, oh, I was just worried about you. Are you at work, did you make it? I said, yeah, I'm fine. I was able to get the number for his company that day and talk to his boss before, because I hadn't talked to them Thursday about, like, why they hadn't go home yet.
Yeah.
And so Friday, before I left work, I called them and talked to them for maybe 30 minutes about kind of what they saw and what had happened. Friday, David and I were supposed to watch my best friend's son for the weekend. And so I was meeting her out in Buffalo. And so I had called him on my way home, just to check in again. You know, he was texting me like it was normal. He wasn't irrational. It wasn't like anything out of the blue.
Okay.
So I called him on the way home. Normal, nothing strange. So I'm driving to Buffalo, and he called and he said, oh, my parents wanted to come over. I said, okay, well, can you just ask them to wait until I'm there? And then he said, I should be home 6:37, somewhere around there. He said, okay. Then he calls me back. Well, why is it that? They're just my parents didn't come over. I said, well, I think there's a lot going on with you, and I would like to be there so that I can understand, you know, what they're seeing, mm-hmm. what they're hearing, what they're saying, and what I can help support you because you're my husband and that sort of thing. He said, okay, I'll tell him. So I went and picked up my friend's son in Buffalo on my way home. I have no idea, like I hadn't talked to him since I left Buffalo.
Okay.
So I get home, bring Owen upstairs, and as I get to the door, I can hear some voices. Open the door. Scott and Nancy are sitting at our dining table. David is sitting there in, I believe, dress underwear, reading the book of Revelation. So at this moment, I'm thinking, shit.
Yeah.
Many other things run through my head, but I'm thinking, okay, like, what's going on? You know, I walk in, and I was like, oh, I didn't think you guys, you know, were getting here until later. Like, I was pretty upset at this point just because, like, I have my French kid. That's just my priority right now, to protect this baby.
Yeah.
But it's also my priority to support my husband. And I was upset that they were already there because I had no idea what happened from the time I hung up the phone to the time I walked in.
Yep.
And this is it's literally insane. It's insanity. They had, Scott and Nancy had brought him some dinner. He wasn't eating, wasn't responding to me whatsoever. We were there for maybe 2 hours at our apartment. And so at that point, I thought he had just gotten drunk from the time he got home until then.
Sure.
And when this happens in the past, I normally would try to get his attention. I'd smack him in the face, grab his face, look at me, what did you drink? What did you take? You know, what's going on? His parents really didn't like that I did that. But, you know, that's another story. And he just, nothing. He just stared deadpan in my face, wouldn't respond. I checked the cabinet where we would keep our liquor. And we had just went to the liquor store like 4 days before or something, mm-hmm. not even. And nothing was open, nothing was less than the levels where it had been.
Okay.
So I was thinking, okay, he either bought a bottle of something and drank it and dumped it somewhere, or he's not drunk and this is a super serious thing. So it was at that point that I was sort of standing at our counter, and I was trying to get the baby, like, some milk, something,
mm-hmm.
and he came and stood inches behind me and just was, like, breathing down my neck saying, you're a sinner, Emily, I know who you are. And I'm a pretty, like, sarcastic person, and so I just sort of, like, trying to play off, like, oh, can I get a little bit of, oh, excuse me, you know, whatever. Like, I wasn't trying to feed into it at all. Not long after that, he stood right in front of me and told me I was, that he forgave me for being a liar, that the Lord, our Savior, forgave me for this. He did take the drug test, I didn't actually see the results myself. I don't remember, like, what they said, but I know his dad said that they were positive for THC, which was expected. I knew that he was using marijuana.
When did that come into play?
The marijuana?
Yeah.
He's used off and on since he was 18. But out in North Dakota, he couldn't because they randomly drug tested frequently. And he moved home in July.
Yep.
And from my understanding, from what he and I talked about, he started using pretty much right away. And I was not aware at the time. And I sometimes would, I think one time I found some, or smelled it, like found the little pieces in his truck, and was, you know, super angry, and then he would stop, you know, so I would calm down, and then evidently he would start back up again. And I think that David really wanted to get better, he really wanted to stop, but he was so addicted to, he used chewing tobacco. He was going through a 10 and a half a day recently. And I think that he would maybe, I speculate that he was maybe even drinking, you know, before he would come home, grab a beer on the way home or something like that. I don't know. I was pretty good about sniffing him out when he was smoking, so he just got really good at hiding it. So this Friday night situation happens. We end up, he won't leave the apartment without our dog, chases the dog through the hallway, picks up our 70-pound golden retriever, brings him inside, and basically doesn't want anything to do with me. He thinks I'm evil, about to get him, whatever. We take him to the hospital, to the ER in Maple Grove. He goes in. He's really, doesn't really understand why he's there, doesn't think he has, there's anything wrong. And he has sort of come down a little bit, like he wasn't super in this delusional state when he got into the hospital, but he still was. Like, it wasn't to the extent where he was like, I was feeling threatened. He was just sort of like, I don't want anything to do with you. Really relying on his parents for everything. Again, very out of the ordinary for him. He was very paranoid in the hospital, very confused, and couldn't remember very much stuff. Because of who I am, I was trying to ask him questions like, did he remember? What time did he get home? What did he do when he got home? What time did I get home? And he was just like, he couldn't remember, so then he would just like make, well, you know, Emily.
Sure.
They wanted to give him, I don't remember what they wanted to give him, I'm assuming it was like some sort of anxiety medication.
Yep.
When he got in. He wouldn't take it for 3.5 hours. They kept coming in every so often to offer it to him, and then when he did finally take it, he, it's like, you know, a 10 milligram pill, it's very small. He, like, picked it up, and he looked at it, asked to see the packaging that it came in. They had to, like, dig it out of the garbage, read the packaging. Like, it was so weird, and I'm just sitting there, like, what is going on? So that's when the doctor said that he is going to put him under a 72-hour hold for psych eval. So we stayed at the, I stayed at the hospital with him until, you know, 2, 3 in the morning when they could get a bed. They transferred him to Fairview Riverside,
okay.
Where he was then until for 10 days. He was there. He refused medication most of the time. Okay. Tuesday he started to come down, and you could talk to him and reason with him a little bit about things. And myself, his parents met with him and the nurse, one of the charge nurses there, and sort of was able to explain to him why the medications were important and how they can help him. Because really at this point on Tuesday, his focus was, all these people are crazy, gotta get me out of here. And so we tried to explain to him, like, you have to take the medications, you have to listen to what the doctors are saying, because that's what's gonna get you to come home. And so he started to do that, and at this point he wouldn't sign a release for me, release of information. He signed one for his mom, or his dad, Tuesday, but he still wouldn't sign one for me. And I really kept pushing it, because I couldn't get any information, and I wasn't sure what information his parents were getting, because I wasn't with them, or on very good terms with them at this point. At one point, his father threatened to take guardianship of David from me. Friday, I went to see him, and it was like the normal David that I would normally see, you know, joking, laughing, like his mannerisms were back to the same thing. I noticed when he was in the, it was like, he would like just stare at a wall for 30, I mean, the kid could barely sit still most of the time. Like, he was fidgety and, always, you know, he was very hands-on. He liked to, like, just be doing the thing a lot. Because the first 3 days he wasn't really cooperative, he wasn't taking medications, the hospital did go through the process to commit him, like, through the county.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he started to get better, like, pretty much right as they did that. You know, he started to come down. And so then they decided to do this continuance of dismissal. I'm still, like, a little bit foggy about what that means, but basically it would be that they're dismissing the petition to commit him.
Yes.
And so he had a court hearing the following Monday, and he went and he wouldn't sign the petition because I don't think he understood what it was, and I wasn't allowed to be in the room with him. So he wouldn't sign it, so I think that really increased his anxiety about having to go back to the hospital. So he did have to go back on Monday, and then on Tuesday, I got a call from the caseworker there, the social worker there, that basically said that the psychiatrist that evaled him at the court couldn't find any evidence to support that he was a danger to himself or others. So because that's why the petition was submitted, there was no grounds for them really to go through with the petition, so they would be dropping the petition.
Sure.
So I brought him home with 1 month's supply of risperidone that he was to take every night.
How was he when you brought him home?
He was a little bit paranoid. I think he was really very nervous about, I think his anxiety was very high about having to go back to the hospital.
Yep.
And he couldn't kind of come down from the fact that, like, it was done, he was coming home, you know, that
right.
sort of thing. You know, he had to sign some paperwork, and he, like, again, read it all, and I was sitting there like, oh, no. You know, like, oh, no, no, no. But it was still him, you know, like, he was paranoid, but I could still see him through all of it. I was like, okay. He came home with the medications, and we had a lot of conversations about why the medications are important and why you need to keep taking them. And he understood and appeared to be compliant with taking them. And so we got home Tuesday. Wednesday, we went to his parents' house to get some skis because he was going to go skiing on Thursday.
Okay.
So we were there for a while, and he was down in his dad's office talking to him for a while, and I chatted with his mom. But I had said something about one time, because his dad went down to take, like, a work phone call. And I said, oh, he's on the phone. And he was like, I need to talk to my dad. Just stay up here. And I was like, okay. Mm. And I tracked behavior. I mean, I was writing everything down. I was keeping track of anything that was off or odd.
Okay.
Just, again, sort of what I do in my day job. So I was just doing it in my, you know, personal life, too. That was sort of weird. We went home. Things were fine. Normal. We had a, you know, good conversations, and he was able to, he was making sense, he wasn't irrational, nothing like that. Friday, so he was able to go back to work on Tuesday.
Okay.
So he only worked Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Sunday, we watched the Super Bowl at my parents. Pretty much a typical day there.
Yeah.
Like, he's pretty quiet. My family's very loud and sort of obnoxious. He just sits there and deals with it. And Monday, he, like, ran a bunch of errands for me that I haven't had time to do, so I was like, wow, that was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Went back to work on Tuesday for, like, half of a day because he had his first appointment with a therapist up in Maple Grove at Nystrom and Associates. Went there. I think a lot of this was started from anxiety. And he, I think, got super anxious. He gets really anxious talking to people because he felt like he wasn't a very good communicator.
Okay.
And that's, he felt that he didn't communicate well to me or his parents, and that's why he got put in the hospital. So there was a lot of anxiety about communication with therapists, doctors, like, he's going to keep me here, that sort of thing. So he had this appointment with the therapist, and I had offered to go with him, you know, just for support. No, it's fine. Well, then I get home and I find out that he had went to ACLBS, which is the Association Free Lutheran Bible School. It's right in Plymouth.
Okay.
And he had went there for 2 years right out of high school, but he never graduated just due to, like, failing classes. He didn't have the credits to graduate. And he, all of a sudden, on Tuesday after meeting with this therapist, thought it would be a good idea to go back to the college and figure out how he could graduate from there. And so I was like, I sort of saw the connection, but something he would never want to do. But he went there and he did that, and then he like told me about it when I got home on Tuesday. He was like, yeah, he was very confused as to why he went there, why he thought that was like a good idea, and he was very like needy, like he needed to talk to me about everything, and he wanted me to give him a lot of hugs and like this affection and be very close. And he took his parents' car to work on Thursday,
okay,
and then had said that he was going to drive back to his parents. They live in Cocado, drop the car off sort of, and then have his dad drive him back home so that we could go get his truck. I said, oh, I was like, that seems like very ridiculous, but I'm not going to argue with you, you know, like I was like, wouldn't it be easy? Because I told him, I was like, I can't take any time off of work to like drive you to work. But you have other coworkers that live in the area. Couldn't you just have one of them pick you up? But no, like it made more sense for him
sure.
to go. And that's where I was like, that's really strange. They came back and his dad had texted him Wednesday night. His dad was sort of, not even sort of, he was pretty rude to me. He yelled in my face a few times about him being in the hospital. When he was in the hospital the first time, and decided that it was time for him to apologize after David had talked to him and David's sister had sort of told him he was out of line. And this was like 2 weeks prior that this incident between his dad and I had happened.
Okay.
And so David was like, yeah, my dad wants to apologize. And I had a terrible day at work on Thursday. Like everything that went wrong, that could go wrong, went wrong. And I was just like, I don't want to deal with this. I just want to go home and snuggle with my dog and my husband and whatever. And so I get home and David's like, yeah, my dad got sick, which is not probably true. But he just didn't want to come and apologize. So I said, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
And David's like, yeah, not surprised. So I said, yep, okay. So we sat there and I'm in grad school too, so I did some homework and David made dinner and nothing out of the ordinary. Took Mosley, our dog, for a walk, came back in. Fine, totally normal, and then everything just went nuts at 10:45.
Okay.
Which I think what time it was.
All right. So just before we kind of move on to that piece of it, like that week that he was home after getting out of the hospital, was he still, you know, using marijuana?
When he was in the hospital, my parents came down and we cleaned out, we looked through everything to find anything. I never found actual marijuana, but I did find like the pipe thing he smoked it in and a glove that he used to break it off the buds or something. I don't really know, but there was a glove and it reeked of,
okay,
and it was all green. So I cleaned all of that stuff out of his truck. Threw it away. Then we took all the alcohol out of our house, and I told him, I said, it's a sober house. Like there's nothing, no chew. You can use a nicotine patch, a nicotine gum. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in agreement. Okay, yeah. And then I never saw him use marijuana. I don't know.
Right.
We weren't on the same bank account. For the reason that he didn't want to see me taking money out.
Sure.
Which he admitted to me in the hospital. He was like, I didn't want to be on the same bank. Because we've been married for 11 months. I was like, come on. And he was always like, no, I can't because of loans and law. And I was like, whatever. I so don't want to argue with you about this. So again, I don't know if he was. I never smelt it in his truck. I checked. I never smelt it on him. So if he was, he was really good about hiding it.
Okay.
Or he was doing it after I went to bed. Which I think was probably the time that he would do it, like after I went to bed. I can guess that he was drinking some only because the day of his funeral, I found a 24-pack of beer in his truck hidden under some stuff. And there was maybe 4 or 5 beers left in it.
Okay.
I don't think he was drinking like a ton, but he probably...
So.
Yeah. I don't remember seeing that in there prior to him being in the hospital.
Okay.
And then he was chewing. So.
Yeah.
And he felt really bad. He'd go and buy a can and then he'd throw it. Like he wouldn't even open it and he'd throw it away. And then I was like, you got, you know, buy something else. Buy Mountain Dew. Buy a snack, you know, something. And then Thursday night he did give in, I guess. I don't know. And was like, I'm having a dip. And I was like, you're 24 years old. You're your own person. But you have to be aware that the consequence is that you're never going to quit chewing.
Right.
And he had like 4 dips. Like, I mean, he would keep it in for an hour, like a long time. It wasn't just like a quick,
yeah.
You know, and so it was almost all night he was chewing, and I finally went up to him and I was like, come on, you can do this, like you're stronger than this. And then he ended up like taking it out, and then it's like, no, you're right, and like he chewed gum or whatever. But yeah.
Okay, so back to the night that he killed himself. You said things kind of went haywire at like 10:45.
So sometimer, I mean, it was between 10:45 and maybe 10:50.
Okay.
We always watched 10 o'clock news, and so I called him to bed, and he was sitting just on the bed next to me watching the news, and I was kind of on my phone half watching the news, and then it was between 10:20 and 10:30, I was like, oh, I'm tired. Like, I'm ready to fall asleep. I'm going to go to bed. Our dog lays there with us on the bed. This is pretty typical. I normally go to bed before he does. And he says, you care if I keep watching the news? And I was like, no, it's fine. Can you just turn it down? Because it's like really loud. So I turned it down like 2 notches. And I was like, no, like, I really am tired. I want to go to bed. And so he turned it down, and I like had a little blanket that I just put over my eyes because the light, he left his light on and the TV was on so I could fall asleep. Pretty normal, like would do this every night. And I do remember sort of waking up at one point, not like waking up, just kind of stirring. And I noticed he was sitting at the end of the bed, which was sort of weird, but then I realized like the volume was down so low, so he probably couldn't hear from the other side of the bed. So I'm like, whatever. And then I was just sort of dozing, not really asleep, but again, I didn't hear anything, any movements from him, and he is not a quiet person, like, he's loud, so I don't know how or why I didn't hear anything.
Okay.
Part of me thinks I didn't hear anything, because had I tried to stop him, he probably would have hurt me.
Okay.
Because of the state he was in, the Friday he went to the hospital the first time, he was very angry with me, you know, and that's sort of my, maybe that's just how I make peace with everything, yeah. Is that. So it had to be between 10:45 and 10:50 that I heard him say, Emily, it's time to get up. And I thought, oh my gosh, I just had my alarm, I overslept, so I like whipped the blanket off my face, and I don't even remember if the TV was on, but his bedside table light was on, and I looked at him, and he's completely naked. And I was like, I was super caught off guard, and I got up. And I was like, what? Like, what's going on? And he's like, he just didn't look like himself. His mannerisms, again, were sort of off, and I was just like, okay. So I immediately, if this is our bed, I sleep on this side, and I have the bedside table here.
Okay.
And my phone was on the bedside table. So I had gotten up and sort of walked around the side end of the bed, and was like, what's going on? You know, and he just kept, it's time to go. It's time for you to go to your parents. Okay. So I immediately said, call 911. So I went to grab my phone. I walked back around the bed. He pushed me. He's never been aggressive. Grabbed my phone. And I said, oh, honey, you know, I need my phone if I'm going to go to my parents. And he just said, you'll get it when you leave. Took his phone, went into the kitchen, and I could see, you saw our apartment, but
yeah.
I could sort of see it just into the kitchen from the bedroom if the door was open.
Yeah.
So I sort of walked out and said, what's going on, David? You know, why do I need to go to my parents? He wouldn't respond to his name. He also never calls me Emily. He normally he calls me Toots is what he called me. So, he normally would say that or M or, you know, funny or whatever.
Yep.
Unless I was like very serious or he was like being dumb. So I was very like, that's weird, why are you calling me that? So as I turned back around, because I was just wearing pajamas, so I went to get a shirt, And I saw his Bible sitting next to his bed. Again, very weird. Since the time we got home from the hospital, his Bible has sat untouched on the kitchen table. So I noticed, triggered, and I was like, oh, what? I just kept going, like, what is going on? What's going on? I grabbed a tank top and a sweatshirt, and as I was doing that, I heard a splashing. What's that? So I came back into that first hallway, and I could see him holding this thing and dumping liquid onto himself. That's when I saw the light that indicates the top burners of the stove was on.
Okay.
And so he was standing facing the stove.
Okay.
Dumping this. Behind that, over here a little bit, is our sink.
Yep.
And we have, like, one of those sprayer things. So my first reaction is, get this off of him, you know.
Yeah.
And so I reached for that. And he pushed me, and I got oil all in my hair. The smell's still not out. Down my arms, my entire front is covered. And I tried to grab my phone, because I couldn't get to, I mean, he's a big, big guy. I couldn't get to the sprayer thing. And then I tried to grab my phone. He pushed me up against the door. And I just started screaming for help. Help, 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 something help. He covered my mouth with his hand. And, he's never aggressive. So this was so out of character for him.
Okay.
He wasn't holding me hard, but he was just trying to get my phone. So I went into the bathroom to rinse the oil off. Because I thought, if he lights this, I'm going up in flames, too. So I was like, I need to get this off of my body. As, you know, I didn't really realize that it was my entire front was covered. I just could feel it on my arm.
Sure.
So I ran into the bathroom, turned the water on, went like this, went back out, and that's when I saw, like, the little clicker lighter with the, like, you light a candle.
Oh, sure.
I saw that, and I was just like, what? And while I was doing that in the bathroom, he had picked up the jug thing again and poured more oil.
Where was the lighter at?
It was sitting behind him on the counter. And so I reached for the lighter, you know, to try and take it with me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have many lighters in the house, but it was just right there.
Right.
So I tried to take it with me and grab my phone. Again, he pushes me to grab the lighter, yell for help. So I'm sort of like up against the door, and I've got my phone in one hand, I've got a sweatshirt, and the lighter, so he's trying to take the lighter. Doesn't care about my phone at this point, just the lighter. He grabs the lighter, but he still sort of pushes me a little bit. I'm able to reach up and grab a key off of our key ring thing. I'm able to grab the door handle, open the door, and he pretty much just pushed me outside, and I was able to call for our puppy. Mosley, come. As soon as the door shut, I unlocked my phone. I started screaming for help. There was a gentleman who lives in the building that was in the hallway. He said, what's wrong? What's wrong? I said, he's starting a fire. Got to get out. I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, I didn't know how big the fire was going to be, how small it was going to be. My dog ran into their apartment, so I had to, get him out.
So they lived a little bit across from you?
Next door.
Oh,
next door. Yeah. So, yeah, there's only one.
Yeah.
Grab him. I said, oh, my God, get him. And I thought I had my vehicle key, but I actually grabbed David's. And so I was running because I keep my car. David keeps his car out front in the front parking lot, but I kept mine in the garage. So I was running down to the garage to get my car. Called 911. Dispatcher picked up. You know, gave them address, all that. Realized when I got to the door, because of the garage you have to unlock with this, I did have my keys. And for a split second, I, started to run back to the apartment. I was like, no, can't do that. Went out a side door. My dog took off. So I talked to the dispatcher, you know, tried to get my dog, got my dog. And then pretty much by the time I got back to David's truck, which was parked in the front, I could hear sirens. I was standing outside when I don't even remember her name, but the responding officer got there. Yes.
Oh.
When she got there and she started running, I ran over to her and I said, I'm the one that called. It's my husband. And I forgot to mention that there was when my dog ran into the other apartment, I looked back and there was just a little trickle of smoke. And so then I put my dog in his truck and then talked to Molly for what seems like an eternity. Yeah. And then sat with her in the car for a while, called my parents right away, called his parents, because I called my mom, so I was like, I don't know what's going on. Don't have a great relationship with his parents. Come down here. So she's on her way. Shortly after that, I got a call from the hospital that said I needed to come down right away. So Molly drove me down, and I called his parents right away.
Okay. I mean, I think you answered most of my questions.
I talk a lot, so I'm
That's good. No, that's good. That's good. You hit everything.
Okay. And I should mention, too, one of my best friend's moms is a police officer. I don't know where, St. Paul, maybe. But she did come over to the apartment and help my mom go through some stuff and sort of told my mom, like, check the freezer, check different places where he may have hidden drugs. My mom checked. She didn't find anything anywhere.
Okay.
And we looked through his entire truck and didn't find anything, so... There wasn't any obvious signs that he was using again. But again, if you want it, you'll figure out a way to get it.
You will, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's really terrible that it, you know, that it had to happen like this, but...
Do you have any questions?
So, I guess most of my questions are just about the death certificates, and I don't even know if you know anything, if you can answer that. I just can't do anything. I'm sort of stuck with, because we're not on the same accounts, so I have to have death certificates to get access to all of that.
So I haven't received the medical examiner's report either, though. Obviously, you're the ones that sign the death certificates.
Okay.
I don't know what's taking so long, other than maybe they're waiting on toxicology reports from our perspective. It's a suicide. You know, it's unfortunate. This one was extremely dramatic and affected a lot of people, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, really, when it boils down to it, I need the medical examiner's report, and there's a report that will be coming from the state fire marshal's office, because they sent an investigator out that night, too.
Yes.
You know, I don't know how in-depth their reports are. It's pretty evident what happened, so it's not like a big mystery that needs to be solved. So I'm waiting for that, and, you know, at that point I will write my report, and this will get closed out. So I try and, you know, answer the questions that the parents have. They're searching for a reason why this happened. You know, that we may not ever know. That answer is, I'm not ever going to have that answer.
No. And I would agree. It's too much of a situation to really fully understand and grasp. And, especially if, you know, you weren't super keen on the idea of a mental illness. If I can imagine that it's much harder to understand.
I think it's, you know, from their perspective, and you too, I mean, this kind of all unfolded pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like this has been, you know, going on since he was 15.
Mm-hmm.
But this is also very common. It's also very common for, you know, the onset of mental illness to happen in your early mid-20s.
I mean, he wasn't out of that age range by any
means.
I miss him, but, you know, I have a piece that he's okay now. Sucks, but I have a huge support system, so I'm doing
good.
What stands out from the police report is that they don't give the real reason for not going in to rescue David. The report clearly reflects the officers were scared for their lives, not to mention they refused to allow over a dozen properly protected firefighters to go in to the apartment. So why didn't they just come out and say, "We were scared as hell, she was screaming that he had knives, had been in a mental hospital, attempted suicide, and was going to light himself in the apartment on fire"? Frankly, who wouldn't be scared as hell if you believed what she was saying? So why didn't they just state the facts? Here's why. Imagine being the command officer holding back the well-protected fire and rescue people for 30 minutes, and then after the windows are shot out to clear the smoke, here comes David in his sad condition. You'd just been instructing the rescue people to stand down for over 30 minutes, telling them David was a serious threat, and now you have a half-mummified person collapsing on the floor in front of you. What do you do? Well, here's what I believe they did. They panicked and attempted to maintain Miss X's lie that David was a serious threat, going to such lengths as planning, yes, that serrated knife, and in order to do this, they had to overlook material evidence, believing later they could simply disguise it as a sloppy investigation. Are you following this scheme? And it gets worse. What should have been obvious problems with Miss X's testimony, as well as extremely damning evidence that would have come to light by then, Mr. Bird asked only softball questions, reassuring her she has nothing to worry about. Here is a sample of some of the problems Mr. Bird should have been concerning himself with and interrogating Miss X about. The open window. In the police report, officer number 130 states, I deployed a 40-millimeter blue tip round into a bedroom window next to the patio door. I then realized the glass window was already open and I only shot through a screen, end quote. One picture taken depicts a 4-foot slider window slid completely open, leaving an opening of about 18 inches, which is a clear indication someone attempted to air out the apartment. As previously stated, there were no oily or bloody footprints leading up to the window. On this night, again at midnight, the outside air temperature was between 5 and 3 degrees, something no doubt Miss X would have noticed and could have been questioned about. This raises a question of who opened it and when. Since there are no bloody or oily footprints leading up to the window, if it was David who had opened it, then he would have preemptively opened it before he started pouring the oil over himself. We believe this is evidence that the fire started before Miss X exited the apartment, certainly something she should have been asked about. Then there's the 911 call. The lead investigator would have certainly known by now that Miss X did not call 911 immediately as she said she did, but 1 minute after the next door neighbor. He would have also learned, had he interviewed the tenant living directly below their apartment, that she had heard commotion 10 to 15 minutes before the alarms went off. This is a significant contradiction to Miss X's testimony, which would have given her 10 to 15 minutes to call 911 before she left the apartment. This should have been a critical piece of information that Miss X should have been seriously questioned about. She wasn't. Then there's the question of the alarms. Miss X has reported that she witnessed no flame and only saw a whiff of smoke, as she put it, coming from underneath the door as she is running down the hall. How does this explain the fire alarms already going off before she exited the apartment, and the fact that the soberly challenged maintenance worker, who was in bed at the time, has already made his way from the first floor apartment to the third floor before Miss X is even 3 doors down? This is such obvious and damning evidence. Could it be any clearer that the Plymouth Police Department had no interest in doing a proper investigation into David's horrific death? And again, back to the locked door. As you have learned, the police knew all along that the door was not locked, yet they upheld this lie for as long as possible because it would be conclusive evidence that started the fire. The evidence of the door not being locked and the false reporting of it by police now became evidence not just against Miss X, but against the Plymouth Police Department as well. It would be pretty difficult to ask Miss X why she reported that David locked the door behind her when the police have been effectively aiding and abetting by telling me it was, hoping that this would be the evidence that would stop my family by making any further inquiry. If the door is locked, there is only one person who could have started the fire.
Do you have a key to open the apartment, or was the apartment door open?
No.
Lastly, If there's a single piece of evidence that clearly demonstrates Miss X's motives and intentions, it is this. Why did she lie and scare the arriving officers so they wouldn't attempt to save David's life? Why did she give false information about David? David never been violent.
And he's never aggressive, so this was so out of character for him.
David had never owned weapons, including knives. David had never been suicidal, and David was not suicidal.
I didn't feel that he was like a threat to himself or anybody else.
How much time would the lead investigator have to invest to find out that this information given by Miss X was false? 10 to 15 minutes, maybe, reading through the medical records? Clearly, her statements prove her intentions and motives. The only reason she didn't want David to be rescued was not to protect the police from being attacked, but because she wanted him dead. Add the forensic and circumstantial evidence, reverse the roles, and have David feeding officers this load of nonsense, and I believe he would have been locked up that night. Keep in mind, this is just a small sample of important evidence that Mr. Byrd would have had at his disposal at the time they met 21 days after David's death. So instead of asking serious questions about the open window, her delayed 911 call, the alarms going off, the locked door, and why she gave false information to arriving officers about David, instead of those important questions, what does the lead investigator do? First, he reassures her she has nothing to worry about, and then throughout the interview, he reassures Miss X that what happened that night was certainly no great mystery, that David no doubt, quote-unquote, killed himself. Here are his reassuring comments. At 39 minutes into the interview, the lead investigator asks her, okay, so let's go back to the night, he killed himself. You said things kind of went haywire like 10:45. Not only is Mr. Byrd providing confidence and support to Miss X's claim that David killed himself, but he is also overlooking the fact that the alarm went off at 10:59, which would give Miss X 15 minutes to call 911 before the neighbor did. This time frame is supported by the neighbor living directly below, who reported to us that she heard pounding and commotion 10 to 15 minutes before the alarms went off.
They were arguing, and you heard voices yelling?
Yeah, I couldn't tell what they were saying, but they were arguing.
Okay.
And loudly going back and forth, because I sit on my couch, so yes. Back and forth. And she was going nuts because she don't like the loud noise.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of walking back and forth, and not lightly, just boom, boom, you know.
Yeah.
And like I said, I couldn't make out what they were saying, but you could tell they were arguing, or people were arguing upstairs. I heard a big boom, like somebody dropped something or somebody fell. So we just sat here, and then a while later, the fire alarm went off.
How is it that a grieving father was able to obtain this information with a simple knock on the door, but the lead investigator couldn't? Sloppy detective work or a cover-up in conspiracy? And why would Mr. Byrd want Miss X to believe he was not considering any other alternative than suicide? Personally, I think he was padding her, and what I mean by that is, when she leaves that interview, he doesn't want her to think for a minute she is being investigated. The last thing he wants is for her to give him more incriminating evidence. At no point does Mr. Byrd deviate from the suicide narrative. It's clear the lead investigator doesn't want to rock Miss X's world. At the end of the interview, Mr. Byrd states the following, quote, "You know, from our perspective, it's a suicide. Unfortunately, this was extremely dramatic and affected a lot of people. Obviously, it's pretty evident what happened. So it's not like a big mystery that needs to be solved. So I'm trying to, you know, answer the questions that the parents have. They're searching for a reason why this happened." Did you get that? Trying to answer the questions parents have? Really? How sad and pathetic. Mr. Byrd made no attempt to ask Miss X one serious question. So what questions does the lead investigator ask during this one-hour interview? Are you ready? Here are his seven questions. So how long were you married to David? Okay, then how long was it before you got back together? Did he get angry a lot? prior to his mental break? All right, so just before I move on to bad pieces, like the week he was home after getting out of the hospital, was he still using marijuana? How long had he been working on water wells? What sparked David going into the mental hospital? Okay, so at what point did things change with David? Was there signs of mental health problems 5 years ago, 2 months ago? Those are all of Mr. Bird's questions, all seven of them, during this one-hour interview. Nothing about the window, her delayed 911 call, the alarms going off before she left the apartment, the locked door, and why she gave false information to the arriving officers about David and his history. Not one serious question. Can it be more obvious what's going on here? Tough to ask her why she gave false information about David being violent and owning knives when they are responsible for planting a knife, wouldn't you agree? As a listener, I'm sure you're wondering what the nail in the coffin is besides Miss X's testimony for ruling David's death a suicide. How could so many professionals overlook what so many people see as evidence? Is there something we are missing? Despite all the reasons to question whether or not this was indeed a suicide, do you want to know what all the experts clung to as definitive evidence that the cause of death was without a doubt suicide? This includes two senior prosecutors, the two pathologists, the state fire marshal, and of course, Plymouth's lead investigator. They all personally brought it to my attention and emphasized it over and over again. So what is this conclusive and definitive evidence? It's the footprints. The professional investigators want us to believe that David was deliberately walking around the apartment, again, fully cognizant of his action, refusing to come out of the apartment because he wanted to die. And this is all confirmed by footprint evidence, so they contend. Let's not forget this irrefutable evidence, and let's not forget David's condition, which I'm not going to repeat. What do the actual photographs of the footprints tell us? Are they that extensive and conclusive that they overshadow everything else? Not even close. Even a casual examination of the photos show only one set of footprints leading away from the living room, and there are only one set of footprints leading into the kitchen and then back out. Keep in mind, the door was propped open when the officers were calling his name, which means they'd only be 20 to 25 feet away from the chair where David, by all forensic indications, was sitting for the majority of the 38 minutes while he waited to be rescued. Clearly, the police officers would have heard David stumbling around in his horrific condition had he been moving around in the apartment, and they would have had some idea of where he was in the apartment. Police did not report, however, hearing any noise and stated they did not know where David was in the apartment. And then there's the problem, what appears to be deliberate contamination. It is remarkable that the investigators would want us to believe that this so-called irrefutable footprint evidence overshadows everything else when they have repeatedly walked back and forth down the hall wearing their patrol boots. And yet, despite this, you can still see one set of bloody footprints leading down the hallway. If this was such critical evidence, you would think the police would want to preserve it, not trample on it, especially when there was no reason for officers to be trampling back and forth in the first place. There was never an active fire when the officers were there, and of course David was never rescued from the apartment, but came out on his own. So why so many boot prints over this slam-dunk, one-and-done evidence? Sloppiness or conspiracy? If it isn't apparent already, the possibility of this being sloppiness is eliminated when you consider the pristine knife. As I've said, between the three investigative agencies, there was a total of 21 pictures taken of this standard kitchen knife that was placed near the chair where we believe David spent the majority of the 38 minutes. This knife, as you have learned, had no blood, skin remnants, or soot on it. It was pristine. Clearly, this knife had been moved after the fire was put out. According to the state fire marshal and the Plymouth police report, Miss X told the arriving officers that David possessed knives. Clearly, law enforcement believed David was a serious threat. What happens then when David musters up enough energy and stumbles out of the apartment in his godforsaken condition and has no weapon? Rather than do the right thing and begin a thorough and proper investigation, Plymouth police planted a serrated kitchen knife in their lousy attempt to make it look like there was indeed a standoff with David. Again, there can be no other explanation. The Plymouth police had the means, the motive, and the opportunity. Here is what the lead investigator writes in his final report about the pristine knife. Quote, "There were two kitchen knives found lying on the dining room floor. I examined the knives along with the Hennepin County Crime Lab and determined that neither had any evidence of bodily fluids on them and neither appeared to have played any role in the incidents." End quote. Did you notice how he just stacked the deck by including the Hennepin County Crime Lab? Now it's not just his opinion, but the opinion of two crime scene investigators. Clearly, two crime scene investigators couldn't get it wrong, could they? Which begs the question, how couldn't the clean and pristine condition of the knife concern two serious investigators? How is it that the two separate agencies that examined the knives, both located in Hennepin County, mind you, simply conclude they played no role in the incident when you have soot, fire extinguisher dust, bloody footprints, burn, flesh and oil on the floor throughout the apartment, and yet a clean knife shows up on the floor and they simply conclude it played no role in the incident? Are not CSI officers trained to detect planted evidence? When turning a blind eye to such an obvious plant make a person or department complicit in that plant and cover up of evidence? Moreover, what does this obvious plant have to say about the integrity of the investigation and any possibility of having a thorough and objective investigation when you have members of the police who are planting and tampering with evidence? This pretty much shuts the door on any such possibility. Sadly, Mr. Bird's omissions don't stop there. He mentions nothing about a missing lighter, but instead wants us to believe the preposterous theory that after pushing his wife out of the apartment, David then throws a towel onto the stove and literally within a few seconds is engulfed in flames. According to our own independent fire investigator, this theory is not scientific, and with almost certainty, the fire could have never started as it has been described by these two fire investigators. Could this conspiracy become more obvious? Yes, it can. Despite the fact that all three agencies took all those pictures of the pristine knife, which they eventually concluded played no role in the incident, they took no pictures of the bathroom. Do you remember what Miss X says about the bathroom in our audio recordings? First, she tells us in the audio recording made before the funeral that on that night, quote, David decided he was going to take a bath. He went and got it way too hot, so he had to drain the water out, so he took two baths. And then he took a shower, end quote. This sounds like a rather strange thing to happen, and then to report it to our family, it appears once again. She is trying to cover herself, expecting questions that will eventually arise because of the mess left in the bathroom. In her interview with the lead investigator, she says, quote, "So I went into the bathroom to rinse the oil off because I thought if he lights this, I'm going up in flames too. So I was like, I need to get this off my body. I didn't really realize it was like on my entire front was covered. I could just feel it on my arms. So I ran into the bathroom, turned the water on, and went like this," end quote. Based upon Miss X's own words, there undoubtedly would have been articles of clothing and towels that should have been photographed and collected for evidence. To have one of the three agencies make a mistake and not take pictures of the bathroom would be understandable. to have all three investigative agencies not take any pictures of the bathroom is both highly irregular and suspicious. If it hasn't dawned on you yet that the law enforcement agencies involved in this case have made every attempt not to do a proper investigation, then maybe this bit of information will. On February 5th of 2020, I received a phone call from a seasoned and highly respected BCA agent, Brent Peterson, informing me that he would not be able to proceed analyzing the fire scene photos, which he had agreed to do. We believed we had identified where David was standing at the time of ignition, and we wanted his input to see if he agreed. Mr. Peterson's supervisor, however, received a phone call from the then Plymouth Police Chief, Mike Goldstein, who objected to the BCA's involvement. In an email from Senior Hennepin County Attorney Alan Harris, I was told that, quote, the BCA is reluctant to get into a case without a request from the jurisdiction which had the case in the first place, end quote. If this is true, then why wouldn't the chief of police request the BCA's involvement? Instead, he shuts down the one agent who is willing to help us out. So where does this leave us? Hopefully, in listening to this podcast series, we have clearly identified that David's case and the people surrounding it need to be properly investigated by a federal agency. As you have witnessed, all the Minnesota law enforcement agencies associated with this case had more than enough time to do their job, but instead elected to stack the deck against a young man who only wanted to live a quiet life and work hard. The fact that Hennepin County would even attempt to do such a thing that involves a young man who was lit on fire is vile and repulsive. In conclusion, have we not clearly demonstrated that each and every one of the professionals and their agencies that have been involved in this case have not only failed us miserably, but have equally participated in a conspiracy against my son? How could it be any other way? Two pathologists who effectively mutilated my son, and for what purpose? They remove all of David's vital organs, including his heart, pretending to be performing a top-notch autopsy, only to intentionally omit the most glaring protected area on David's body and the only area on his body that is not burned. Two fire experts concluding a most preposterous ignition source and cause of the fire that even a fifth-grade science class would conclude was simply stupid. Forget the opinion of our top-notch independent fire expert. Two CSI agents, one from Hennepin County Crime Lab, conclude that the obvious knife plant played no role in the incident. Again, something an elementary school kid would beg to differ with. And then last but not least, two senior Hennepin County prosecutors who knowingly attempted to use false information, the locked door, and looked over not sloppy work, but several intentional criminal actions to stack the deck so that my son's brutal death could not be properly investigated. Could this conspiracy be any more evident? We need to ask ourselves, how many times can a man turn his head and pretend he just doesn't see?
I don't know how you have my son telling my wife and I that if he went back and told his wife that he wanted to leave her, she'd go ballistic. She says she doesn't remember if they talked about David moving home the night of the fire. She goes and washes oil off herself in the bathroom while her husband stands naked in the kitchen with oil poured over himself with a lighter. She tells my family she tried to get back into the apartment, but the door locked behind her.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, the police did say the door was locked when they got there, didn't they?
No, they did not. Maintenance workers, they opened the door, it was open, and that's in their testimony. know, hey, I told David, don't go back. I don't want you to get into it with her tonight. I said, you're not in any shape. Can you take a long break from your job tomorrow, get as much stuff, move home and then call her. You'll be in a safe environment. The next thing I know, my son is dead. Everything that this gal says, she's lying, and I don't say make that point lightly.
And she may have been a bad person. I'm not trying to defend her or approve of anything she did or didn't do, but...
And then you go back and look at the pictures, and you say, there's no lighter there. And you know they're lying. And you know they're lying.
Was there any fire anywhere when you went in?
Yeah, I see not a very big spot, but it was right there at the dishwasher. But I think we pretty much had the fire out before the fire department got there.
When something like this happens, our patrol officers try and get a statement from any witnesses or involved parties the night that it happened.
Did you make a statement to the police of the whole incident, or did you just basically clear out of there?
I cleared out of there. They never asked me for any type of statement, really, whatsoever.
Thank you for listening. As a listener, I know there's always ways that you want to help, and there's plenty of things you yourself can do if you feel the information presented in this series warrants a proper investigation by the DOJ and the FBI. You can do one or all of the following. First, tell your friends and family to listen to this podcast and sign the petition at change.org. The link for that is in our show notes. You can also call the DOJ at 202-514-2000 and call the FBI at 202-324-3000. You can also call your local investigative journalist and tell them about David's story. We believe that if enough people hear David's tragic story, the proper authorities will have no choice but to respond. Thank you for listening and for your support.